The problem that we were just talking about, declining union membership, you can see here fairly dramatically. At the beginning of the century, unionisation was about around about 20% or a bit less. In fact, even a bit more than that, 30-ish percent by 1914. It then got up, in fact, close to 60-ish percent by the mid-60s. And then it's done this remarkable plummet down to 19% in 2008. So we're in a situation where in the last 40 years, in ballpark terms, we've lost 40% of the union membership. And it hasn't gotten any better in recent years. You can see here from 1991, we were at 2.5 million unionists, and it's now dropped to about 1.75 million unionists out of, you know, 10 to 11 million workers, depending on how you count them. So it's not a pretty story. 42% of the public sector are still in unions, but of course, as you know, the public sector is relatively small in the, versus the private sector. In the private sector, it's only 14%. And so we're well on track for that situation, unless things change, in the United States, for instance, where there's only 5 or 6% of people in the private sector in unions, unless something changes. Interestingly, education and training, the sector that Brian's in, has the highest level, 40% of unionisation. And of course, the lowest level is professional, scientific and technical services. There's a union in that area you might know of, a PESMA. So 4%. I'm going to, as I promised in something you may have seen, see if I can barbecue a few sacred cows for you, because there's definitely some sacred cows in this area, as there are, is everywhere. So I'm going to talk first about unions today. I'm going to talk about what Australians want from unions according to the polls and according to research we've done, because we speak to, we currently recruit around about 1,200 union members a month and about 600 members of charities like the United Nations High Commission for Refugees. And so in order to recruit actually as members 1,200 a month, we have to talk to about 10,000 people a month, ballpark at least. So we've got a reasonably good sense of what people think about unions. I'm going to then talk about approaches, different approaches to recruitment. Then I'll talk about what I call the political economy of union recruitment, and I'll show you some number crunching in that area, not the kind that we otherwise know up here. And then we're about where to next. So unions today. Interestingly, when I talk to people who are 20-something, a lot of them have never heard, really, seriously, never heard of unions, let alone have any sense of what they do. And that then among some of my progressive and left friends, particularly some of my Green friends, they say it's a has-been story, thank you very much. What can they do for me? In fact, some of the things that I would like to see in the world, they say to me, unions oppose. This is why I think unions are still critically important. Pay, protection and influence. They are the best way to get each of those. And secondly, they are massive social movements. I mean, the Green organisations are big. They think they're big and they are big. You know, Greenpeace, over 100,000 members, probably 200,000 members. And that's the biggest of them. But, you know, by comparison with unionists, even now, after 40 years of decline, we're talking about, you know, 1.7 million people still in unions. And there's still massive potential for even things like, you know, greening the world workplace by workplace that still hasn't really been tackled if we want to find another way to actually deal with global warming, do the things that the politicians are not doing. And so when you start thinking about this issue, what is to be done to reverse that kind of decline in union growth, what struck me after I'd been looking at this for a while and looking at the reasons, it's one of those classic situations where you can look at all the external problems, but then you turn around and look at what's going on within the movement and within unions. And the conclusion that I've come to, which I want to take you through, is that what's not being done or what is being done inside unions is actually a bigger problem than all the things we face in what you might call the external world, which are still significant. And those internal problems are these. If unions ever had recruitment skills, they don't have enough of them now. And some of those reasons are because, you know, there used to be closed shops, there used to be real strong institutionalization of unionism, it's gone. There also now, in my opinion, is an inadequate methodology to be plied about it inside at least some unions about how they should be doing recruiting. And it's like a hot debate. And it's not an easy debate to have. There's some things that I'm saying today that are not easy to say in other circles. There's also a degree of lethargy out there. I constantly run across the point of view, don't recruit us any more members, thank you very much, because that means we have to do a lot more work servicing people. Or to go and get those people is actually hard work. And it is. Both correct. But still not a good reason. And lastly, I don't think there's enough number crunching of what I call the costs and returns of, you know, membership, which I'll take you through. The external problems are certainly serious. You know, there's been a worldwide decline in any kind of membership organisation, whether it's the Labour movement, in the Labour Party, whether it's, you know, bird clubs, or whether it's, you know, unions. Anything you have to belong to as a member, on average, have declined, with the odd exception of things like the environmental movement, for instance. And I think one of the reasons why the environmental movement has grown is because they are extremely good at recruitment and fundraising. You know, I learned a lot of the things I learned from Greenpeace. Obviously, right-wing attack, concerted a right-wing attack in the last 20 years. But, you know, there's always been right-wing attacks on unions. So it's not, that's nothing new. It's got a bit worse in the last 20 years, but not dramatically so. There's, even under the current laws, there's very great restrictions on access to the workplace. Access to the workplace in Australia, for example, is much worse than it is in New Zealand under either the Labor government or the Conservative government in New Zealand. And lastly, there's very little discussion in any kind of productive manner of what I call the productivity issue. Now, this is a problem because, you know, if you're going to get more competitive and therefore have more jobs or have your job secure, as well as potentially make a situation where there's room for wage increases, you have to engage with productivity. And in fact, the Fair Work Australia law says you can't have a wage increase unless you can get a productivity increase. And so unless you're engaging with that discussion between bosses and workers and unions, then, you know, there's not much of a way forward. And yet there's no, as I'll show you, good discussion about this issue. And, you know, all you have seen for the last 20 years is what you see in this cartoon. You see, you know, bargaining, really, it's basically bosses taking away conditions and calling it productivity growth. And that's not productivity growth. So the conclusion I got to is this, you know, clearly, you know, unless, if you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. And in the last 15 or 20 years, let alone the last 40, we've had massive decline. So we need to look at some massive new approach. You know, Einstein said it beautifully, you know, a long time ago, you can't solve your problems with the existing paradigms. You have to get out of the existing paradigms. And there's only three options here. We're talking about growth, plateau, or decline. And really, at the moment, we're still in decline, although it's slowing slightly than it, from what it has been. But if we're going to get into a growth situation, I don't think we're going to get there unless we have a new approach, a new paradigm. Nothing else is going to move us sufficiently. So that's why I'm talking about some new paradigms. But these new paradigms are absolutely controversial in the labour movement. Brian's union, he's going to tell you a lot more about this, but Brian's union is absolutely one of the success stories. They've recruited 6,000 new members thereabouts in the last 18 months. They've had a long track record of growth. They're at 42,000 members now, up from 25,000 10 years ago when Brian became the secretary of the union. And they're recruiting now at the level of 500 to 700 a month. So this is one of the real success stories of unionism in Australia. So it demonstrates it can be done. And certainly the approach I'm going to share with you is one of the ways in which it's been done. And again, it's employing essentially the sort of things that I learned from the charity sector. You know, I did it with Greenpeace, I've done it with the Cancer Council, and it's really just good old-fashioned asking, engaging with people, having a conversation, having some dialogue, finding out what they want, seeing what you can do, and offering it to them. And signing them up on the spot. You'll still find one of the greatest problems in the union movement is people walk around work sites giving out paper and not walking away with signed forms. I call it pelican organising. Fly in, fly out, and leave a few droppings. And the CPSU-WA, another success story there at a historical peak of 15,000 now, and there's several others. So what Australians want from unions? And this is interesting in the sense that it's similar across blue and white collar. And it's very simple. One, they want protection. In this day and age, everybody gets into a spot of bother at work. Who hasn't been into a spot of bother at work? And they want people to look after them. Secondly, they want influence. Thirdly, they want pay rises. 40 or 50% of them want protection. 20 or 30% of them want pay rises. So protection is more important than pay rises. But pay rises are still very important. And lastly, they want savings. But interestingly, when you go and ask them that in a poll, they will give you a less truthful story than when you go and talk to them one-on-one. When you go and talk to people one-on-one in the privacy of their own conversation and you offer them this and this and this and this, they're actually much more interested in savings than they will tell you in a poll, which is consistent, one of the standard sort of biases you get in polls. But all of those things are benefits. People want benefits. You know, really straightforward. We all want benefits. And there's lots of benefits in the union world. I won't go through all of these, but these are just some of them, right? Under each one of those categories, under pay, influence, protection, savings, there's endless benefits. And probably the least known benefits are these. Things like Union Shopper, which can get you an 8 to 11% discount on virtually anything you want as a consumer, leveraging the buying power of 1.7 million unionists in Australia. Things like Ambassador Card, which gives you another slab of savings. Legal insurance, health schemes. Brian's got a health scheme. Look, you know, 20% of people join the AEU, highly influenced by the fact that they've got such a great deal on their health scheme. Doesn't mean to say it's not a good union, but they join, that gets them over the line. Then there's housing loans, things like Journey Cover. If you get squished on the way to and from work, you know, Journey Cover will cover you. And because, you know, John Howard took it away. John Howard took away Journey Cover and it's never come back, so now you have to get private insurance to do it. And other various discount insurance deals, that sort of thing. So, you know, most people haven't got a clue that those things are available to them. And they can save you much more money than any union dues will ever cost you. And what's in it for individuals? You get a mere 1,700% return on your union dues. You know, much better than any superannuation. You know, you invest $450 on average in your union dues and you get back $7,600 over 3 years in the usual collective cycle situation, collective bargaining situation. So, you know, this is the best way to spend your money. Better than super, better than housing appreciation. And the other interesting thing that's been studied worldwide in Australia and every other country, studied academically, there's a heap of academic literature on this, is that the more people you have in a union, the better deal you get. So if you have, for example, you know, 80% in a union or above, you get a much better deal than if you've got 60% in the union. And if you've got 60% in the union, you get a much better deal on average in your collective bargaining than if you've got 30% in the union. So there's a straight correlation. So for all those free riders that we all run into all the time out there saying, oh, you know, I'll leave it to everybody else, the reality is if they get on board, then you can double your returns in ballpark terms. And as I said, the shopping as well will save you much more than it will ever cost you. So essentially, protecting your butt by the union and getting yourself a massive wage increase is free. It's free because you're actually saving it on your daily, weekly shopping. So it's a great deal, you know. And who's ever heard the deal put to them like that, right? Well, you're just like everybody else, right? Because 40% of Australians say they've never, to their recollection, been asked to join a union. Only 4.5 million workers. Never been asked. And the only way they'll ever be asked is by going up to each one of them, having a chat conversation, eyeball to eyeball, putting them a proposition. And that's true no matter what you're joining, whether you're joining the Labor Party or the Greenpeace or the union movement or anything else. Because all the rest of the 10,000 messages we get per month or whatever don't cut through as much as getting to people eyeball to eyeball. So some different approaches to union growth. There's two. And they are these. One which is summed up by the little phrase, anger, hope and action. You've probably also heard of it called the organising approach. And I'll tell you about it in a minute. And the second one, which we use and which we call the benefits and choice model. And the anger, hope and action model is basically this. Find an issue in the workplace, whether it's, you know, parking spaces or underpayment or whatever, and generate some upset and anger about it. Raise a hope that it can be fixed. Encourage some collective action, including joining the union. And overall, in the process of all of that, little focus on benefits. It was invented in the United States, pushed heavily by the AFL-CIO during the 90s and even earlier, and was a total failure. Unionisation continued to decline. What did we do? We imported it. And we've been using it in some parts of the union movement for the last 15 to 20 years. And what did we get? That. Not surprising, really. So, you know, how do you revive a dead horse? And buy a larger whip? Redefine death? You know, some people in the New South Wales government very good at that. Form a committee to investigate the death? Or appoint a new rider? Or follow the ancient Hopi wisdom, get off! So, this is the second option. Give people what they want. Pretty basic. And those things they want are what I just went through before. Protection, pay, influence and savings. Those are the key benefits they want. And that every union has researched those, uphill and down dale. Blue and white collar. And then you've got to use a process to actually ask them. And then you've got to invest in it. Because every new member costs you somewhere, as you'll see in a minute, somewhere between $500 and $4,000 each, depending on how you're doing it. And so these are the six steps that we use. And again, very simple, straightforward methods. They work. I've used them all over the mountains. I've used them all over Australia. I've used them for Greenpeace. I've used them for the Cancer Council. I've used them for the Labor Party. I've used them for unions. And they're these. Build rapport. Rapport is simply getting someone comfortable with you, making a friend. We call them 5-minute friends. No one will ever do anything with you unless they like you. So you've got to make a friend first. Suss out whatever issues is important for them. Sometimes there's some, sometimes there's none. Then present those benefits we just went through before. Then give them some proof of what you're telling them, because you're competing with those 10,000 messages a month. Then make an ask, and then negotiate all the usual objections like, you know, I have to talk to my partner, or I like to think about it, or blah, blah, blah. There's only about a dozen of them, but they come in all sort of variations. And in the process of all of that, what it means, unions would have to put more focus on recruitment, more focus on what they do now. And these are the main three things that unions do. They recruit, they organise and service, and they educate and politicise and communicate. And there is a large debate going on inside the union movement now, and it's one that's been going on for a good 100 years or so, as to which one of those things comes first. And some people would say you can't recruit until you organise. Others would say you can't recruit until you educate or politicise. What I say is it doesn't matter. You can do any of those three things in any order. But you certainly have to put more focus on the recruitment in the process. And what's happening at the moment is, by and large, on average, unions are spending an awful lot of time down here in educating, politicising, organising and servicing, and not enough up here in recruiting. The actual process after that is very straightforward. Train people, research all the possible sites where they could be. Like, for instance, for Brian's union, Brian has 4,000 work sites across Victoria. Schools, early childhood, TAFEs. So you have to know who's who in the zoo in every one of those work sites. You have to know what the total staff potential is. You have to know how many members there are there now already. You know who the principal is, all of that stuff. And on average, unions across Australia don't know that at the moment. You have to then schedule visits, a lot more visits than are currently. On average at the moment, sites are visited twice a year if you're lucky. We visit them 6 times a year. And when we run into someone who says, you know, what are you here for? We're here because we want to get you a better pay rise next time. And people are up for it. You recruit on-site and off-site. You know, it hasn't even started off-site recruitment in Australia on average. You know, door-to-door has been around for a long time for, you know, the Salvation Army and the Labor Party and union, but not for unions. Green organisations, but not in the, you know, and a lot of sites like Telstra. You know, we're doing some recruiting for Telstra, against Telstra. And you cannot get into Telstra sites, full stop, end of story. And so you have to do it off-site or not do it. Then industrial issues are increasingly, and this is one of the things that is happening inside the union movement, which is good, but it's still not all the way there yet. There's been a proliferation of what they call phone servicing rooms. Brian's got one these days. Most unions have got one. Like 3/4 of the unions in Australia have them these days, where basically if you call a union these days, it goes straight to a phone servicing centre, where you get a lot better of service on average than a traditional organiser will do in the field in the one-on-one conversation. And lastly, welcome calls, communications, networking, all of that sort of thing. You know, you've got to make friends, serious friends of people once you get them on board, to keep them on board. And that's all that process is about. And then servicing, of course. So I want to take you through now just some of the numbers that you have to work through if you're going to make this stuff work. Because, you know, the process of recruiting people when they're costing you $500 at the cheapest level to $4,000, as I'll show you in a minute, is a massive investment exercise. And it is for Greenpeace, it is for anybody if they're going to get people on board. Well worthwhile, but it's, I'll show you how worthwhile. So I won't take you through the numbers, but if you look at the total number of people recruited as an organiser, in some unions, you'll be spending at least $1, $2, $3, $4 million on those organisers. You divide that through by the number of people they recruit, and in the average union, it's anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000, $4,000. There it is, $2,500. That's one particular union. Here's another particular union. This is the highest one I've run across because I've crunched the numbers across about 20 different unions now in Australia. And that one there is $3,800 to bring a new member on board. And if you're even at the level of 2,400 to bring a new member on board, you're looking at 59 months, you know, 5 years almost, to pay them off, which means they've got to stay 10 years. And if you're in Brian's game, a professional union, white-collar union, they do stay 10 years. They stay 10 years plus. And so you make a lot of money on every member you bring on board. And so you can afford to go and get more, even at that cost. And that cost can be reduced substantially. This is what happens, and this is true of any kind of membership organisation. The ones who are going to drop off early, and then the ones that are going to stay on increasingly long. This is one of the numbers that's not done inside the Labor Party on average. No one could tell you on average how long the average Labor member starts. You know, it's driven very much by, you know, what happens in the initial 12 months. The initial 12 months is predictive only in the sense of, you know, what's going to happen in that long curve, which is entirely predictable in most organisations. There's the numbers. If someone's giving you $500 a year, which they are in the average union, they're staying 5 years, they're giving you $2,500. Where they're staying 10 years, they're giving you $5,000. So that's the political economy of recruitment. You know, you can afford to spend to get them on board. But unless you crunch those numbers and are aware of that, and are spending the right amount of money, you haven't got a chance of building a membership base. And you can see there, you know, one member costs $550, stays 5 years in this case, you're making 2,200 net. Bring on 1,000 of them, you're making 2.2 million net. You know, not a bad game to be in. This is one of Brian's campaigns, Ballpark, right? 3,500 people recruited, 10-year value of those people, about 19 million. Costs a couple of million to bring them on board. Cool, 17 million, but you get it over the next 10 years. So there's a few cash flow problems, but still it's a good game to be in. And you can afford to do it. And interestingly, a 9-to-1 return. For every $1 you put into it, you get 9 back. So this is the kind of thing that's being done out there in some parts of the union movement. This is a real union with 26,000 members federally now, and sadly declining, and been declining like that for a long time. 10 years' time, it'll be down to 17,000 members, notwithstanding the fact that they're doing some recruitment. If you plug in the kind of recruitment effort we're talking about here, and the kind of stuff that Brian's heavily engaged in, for example, this is the kind of thing that can be done. You know, rather than be down to 17,000 in 10 years, you can be up at 80,000 in 10 years. What that does in terms of your income is this purple line here. And this crossover point here shows that you make money after 12 months. And that's true of any membership organisation. So if you go out there and use these methods to recruit, you can bring people on board, and you can bring them on board very cost effectively, where you're making serious net money in a relatively short period. So where now? Where do we go with all of this knowledge of what could be done? So it's us, not them, is a revelation that needs to be followed through. You know, it's not the external problems, it's the internal problems that need to be addressed. Because the external problems have always been there. It's the internal issues that can be changed and should be changed if we're going to address this. Massive growth can be achieved. One of the debates going on inside the union movement is the extent to which you have to campaign. Campaigning definitely helps with recruiting, but you don't have to go and campaign in order to recruit. You can go and recruit without campaigning. The best proof of that is Brian does extremely well when he is campaigning for wage increases, and he'll show you some of that. But interestingly, when he's not campaigning specifically for his next wage rise or something like that, we can still go out there and sign up a lot of people. Servicing is a dirty word in significant parts of the union movement, because some people think your role in a union is to campaign, not to service. Whereas if you're the average punter member out there, thank you very much, you want to be serviced. You don't have to be angry to join. In fact, the pollsters working for John Howard got it right when they said Australians wanted to be relaxed and comfortable. And we ignore that at our peril if we think we can stir up ongoing anger. Australians aren't like that. They'll just take the benefits, thank you very much. People don't like being angry. They join for the benefits. And there's some parts of the union movement out there think that if they just join for those benefits, they're not real unionists. Whereas, again, in the polling of unions that have been done, it shows that there's only about 10% of people who are rusted on, ideologically committed unionists. And so, you know, the other 90%, if we want them, we've got to go and do something else to get them on board. We might be able to bring some of those 90% over to the 10% eventually, you know, raise their ideological commitment. But they certainly don't start there. And again, out there, there's a serious concern that productivity and all that clever stuff just means you work harder. And then, in fact, that's not the case. You know, you can work smarter without working harder. And again, inside the union movement, on average, productivity is not talked about, because there's a fear that if you're talking about productivity and stuff like that, then you're just selling out the workers and you're a sellout union. And, you know, we all know there is one or two tame cat unions out there, and people are scared of being classified like that. So the new realities are these. People will join if you ask them correctly, and they'll join in their droves. And that's all about giving people what they want and telling them about it. That 4 million people who haven't been told yet. You have to spend more on benefits. You know, unions spend a certain amount on benefits now, but it could be souped up a lot more yet. You know, to get people out of Telstra, we are constructing new benefits packages because we have to get them to come down to the street and talk to us in the street. And we need some enticements to get them there. Recruitment depends on investment. It's a total function of investment, as I've just shown you. You know, if union members cost you at least $500, then you've got to spend serious bucks on it to get them on board. And that cost per member of, you know, $2,000-$3,000 is ridiculous, and it should be brought down, and it can be brought down, and there's ways to bring it down. Unions are service organisations. You know, ask any member. They're there to be serviced, thank you very much. And if you're not servicing them, you won't get them, and if you do get them, you won't keep them. And in that sense, unions need to professionalise the service levels that they have. And there's room for a whole conversation around collaboration on productivity in a way that doesn't sell out the workers, doesn't sell out the unions, but does engage. Because, look, we all know that, look, the people who know the most about how to make any workplace work better are the workers. And unless the boss is engaging with the workers and getting that information, then, you know, you're not going to get the productivity increases which underlie and drive the potential for wage increases, let alone job security. Because wages on average, workers on average will take their job before they'll take a wage increase. We used to go door knocking for the AMWU in Western Sydney. If I knocked on the door, knock, 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 and said, "G'day, I'm Stuart McGill, I'm from the union," they would close the door. If I said, "Oh, look, I'm here, you know, interested to hear about, you know, your job and, you know, security of your job and, you know, what else is going on and that sort of stuff," then happy to talk, you know, and then I can lead into all the other stuff. So what can be done? Each union needs to analyse these sorts of things we're talking about, the investment, their own returns, and recruit and reposition at the same time. They need to bring on recruitment off-site and on-site. And I think over time you'll see eventual large door-knocking campaigns run by several unions. There needs to be mass repositioning campaigns. I mean, the Your Rights at Work campaign was a start of repositioning. But interestingly, it didn't spend any money at all on recruitment. They spent $20 million and union membership declined because they didn't ask the right way. It's quite possible to do that kind of a campaign and at the same time bring people on board. And as I said, productivity discussions. These principles I'm talking about that come from the charity sector have been applied successfully in the union sector, can be employed in any membership organisation. This is an actual case. This was a major charity in Australia where we began monthly giving work down here. And you can see that in the first couple of years, it was a break-even situation, and then it started to take off. The income, the blue is the income. And so the expenditure actually decreased and the income took off. And that's true of any membership organisation because after a very short while, after a year or two, this kind of growth becomes exponential if you keep doing it. So don't flog dead horses and chuck more cows on the barbecue.